Janet Groth had big dreams when she moved to New York in 1957. Fresh from the Midwest, she landed a big interview with The New Yorker and was eager to begin a career as a writer. She was so eager that she didn't even learn how to type at a professional level, hoping she might avoid being placed in the secretarial pool. After interviewing with the legendary writer E.B. White, Groth was hired to work as the receptionist on the 18th floor. She held that post for 21 years and writes about it in her new memoir, The Receptionist, An Education at The New Yorker. Janet Groth joins us this morning to discuss her memoir, The Famed Writers Whose Messages She Delivered, Dogs She Walked, Houses She Sat, and Children She Watched, and why she thinks she was never able to advance at The New Yorker. Janet Groth, it's a great pleasure to have you join us this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I think very highly of NPR. I used to listen to it regularly. Out of Albany, as I came through from Plattsburgh, New York, down to New York City, and on Vermont Public Radio when I went to the Vineyard every spring.
Well, it is a delight to have you here, and I have to say this book was a delight. I picked it up about 2 weeks ago and read it and just enjoyed it more than I can say.
That's wonderful.
If you're a fan of The New Yorker, I guess these are all the stories that at least I've wanted to hear for a very, very long time.
Lovely to hear.
At what point did you decide that you were going to write it? It has been quite a while since you left, and you worked there until 1978. So it has been many, many decades since you left the magazine. Why did you decide now to write about it?
That's right. I think its genesis came, that is the really final push to be serious about digging out all those old notebooks and getting down to business, was after I'd finished with my collaborator David Castronovo, our last book on Edmund Wilson called Critic in Love, after which he went on to do his own work. And I thought, well, it's time you got on with your own, Janet. And what about all those notebooks? What about that memoir on the New Yorker years? And that's when it began. So I really worked on it for about 10 years before I sold the book.
You start off, just the story in and of itself is amazing because of the names that you were around. And you get this job interview with E.B. White. And did you have any sense of what you were walking into? You wanted to be a writer. That's why you headed to New York.
That's true. It was the dream I brought with me, as did so many thousands of would-be writers with their novels in their suitcases, or at least a few short story prizes, which was my case. And I think it was because of my concentration on fiction that for so long I didn't realize that what I ought to have been doing was submitting nonfiction talk stories and so on to the magazine, in the way that a great many of the more confident women and certainly all of the men who came through and got entry-level jobs, perhaps in the checking department rather than as typists or as receptionists.
What was that interview like with E.B. White? Did you get a sense of what the culture of the place was going to be like from that very brief interview?
Oh, incredibly so. This mask I don't know, a low profile normalcy that bordered on the abnormal. Mr. White was so low key that he could scarcely bring himself to look at me or speak to me. He was very, very shy, and the ridiculous part of the interview is that it was that I was trying to put him at ease, which is usually the reverse, I think.
And that shyness is funny, because we read about that in several of the large figures in this book, including William Shawn, who we think of this towering editor, but also a very shy man.
Indeed he was, and he spoke a little above a whisper. Perhaps Mr. White and he were identical twins in that regard. But yes, they had tremendous power, tremendous reputations, and yet they seemed not to manifest that in their daily lives.
You were the receptionists. So that was the job you were hired to do. And as it was originally laid out to you very early on, what were your duties?
Simply to keep track of those writers and editors who were on my floor. In the beginning, very few of them, as Miss Daisy Terry, who hired me, remarked, there was scarcely any traffic on that floor, but the editors upstairs on the power floor, 19, and a few on 20, would need to know where they were and to be able to have a liaison downstairs. Also, someone had to take their messages when they were not in and see that they were coming and going in some sort of regular fashion, so I knew where they were. After I had my very brief stint up in the art department, a six-month stint which represented the only promotion I had, and that was working among the cartoonists in the art department on 20, I was not a good fit up there. And when I came back from a trip to Europe, I discovered that I was being offered a kind of consolation prize for not going back to the art department, an expanded 18th floor reception desk. They had, meanwhile, bought out Exide Battery, which shared the 18th floor with the New Yorker. And there were then 40 artists and writers, mainly writers, on the 18th that I took care of for the next 20 years.
So these are the old offices on West 43rd Street.
That's right, which, subscribed to that low-profile idea. We had linoleum floors and gray walls. Anybody who's thinking about the glitz and the chrome and the glass and the carpeting of the Mad Men offices had better relegate that to Madison Avenue and those ad men. The sober sides over on 43rd Street were definitely filing cabinets and gray walls.
And this amazing opportunity that you had to work with these writers and to have these brushes with these people, everyone from Salinger to Woody Allen to and this list is just absolutely incredible. Calvin Trillin, of course. At what point do you recognize how special that is originally, or does that come in retrospect?
No, I think that one of the daunting aspects was how early on I recognized it and how daunting I found it. I had already revered the New Yorker from the days when I was at the University of Minnesota campus, leafing through its pages, unable to afford a subscription in those days, and so hanging out to read Cheever or look at the cartoons at the local pharmacy.
When I do want to talk about the time, your very brief time working in the cartoon department. Of course, this is in the art department, responsible for the cartoons. This is interesting because it is such a famed part of the magazine. It is how many people recognize and regard the magazine through the cartoons. And it's safe to say that your time there was very unhappy. You just didn't like the work.
Well, that's true. I was assistant to the assistant of the art director, a man named James Garrity in those days, and he really liked Feist and the women who were to deal with the cartoonists who came in weekly to find out whether their roughs had been rejected or accepted for future issues. And I tended to sympathize and empathize with the cartoonists and hated to give them any bad news. And this was not the right stance. Also, I had an unhappy love affair with a young cartoonist who took advantage of the naive girl from Minnesota in classic fashion. And that pretty well, the two things pretty well wrecked my time there in terms of my emotional life.
And the how much of that I guess I'm trying to find a tactful way of asking this question of how much
but there was a suicide attempt? Is that where we're going, in Bellevue and all of that?
Oh, actually, no. I wasn't headed there at all.
You were going to spare me that, and me and my big mouth.
Well, what I was going to ask you, and you can share with whatever you wish, is how much. Given what you were doing, had a result where your personal life and your professional life collided?
Well, I think it was almost a perfect storm, because I was the part that the editors of the magazine had no way of knowing was that I was the child of an alcoholic, a grocer out in a very small town in northern Iowa. And I came with what are now perfectly well recognized as issues of self-esteem, and without the wonderful aids of Oprah and assertiveness training and all the feminist era that would have perhaps bucked me up in terms of dealing with all that, I just crumpled.
And when you look at a profile, a high profile job like that, where you are receptionist, we read of these great vacations that you had, the time that they would give, the amount of time that you would have off in the summer. But it does seem, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say it was partly because they could spare me so well. I was doing so little. All somebody had to do to fill my desk was to forward mail to everybody who was out in the Hamptons and on their own summer vacations between July 4th and Labor Day. So as long as I wanted to stay away, as long as I could afford to do so on my quite liberal 4-week with pay, and then longer if I wanted to stay away, maybe the whole summer, that accounted for those trips to Europe, that and those cheap rail passes in those days.
And when you look at the people, again, going back to the people that you worked with, J.D. Salinger and James Thurber and Woody Allen and Calvin Trillin, of Muriel Spark, that some of those would be just brushes with greatness, and other would be regular working relationships.
Well, it's true, and then I had this terrific privilege of having been brought to the attention of Joseph Mitchell, who was not actually an 18th floor denizen. His office was on the 20th, which I think only a couple of other writers, Lillian Ross and Brendan Gill, had offices up there. The majority of them were on my floor, but Joe Mitchell and I. We were at Costello's one night. I don't know if you know that legendary bar.
Sure.
On Third Avenue. It used to be under the L. And in any case, he heard me quoting from James Joyce's The Dubliner: "Men is nowadays only all palaver and what they can get out of you." It's Lily the maid in The Dead, and he completely focused on me from that time on to the end of the evening, and from there on we went to lunch and had literary conversations every Friday for the next 7 or 8 years. It was wonderful.
A standing Friday lunch that you characterize as innocent but not quite innocent.
Well, yes, I think that covers it.
You look at the fact that you never left the 18th floor except for that brief foray in the art department, and it's something that you explore here in the book, of course. And ultimately, is that why you left?
Well, I had to find a way out, and thanks to the handsome insurance coverage, 80% of my psychoanalysis, which did provide me with the perspective and the self-esteem, thanks to my good analyst and his zeroing in on my work toward a doctorate as the avenue out. He said to me when I asked him, "Do you think I can get a PhD?" He said, "Don't you think it's about time you did something that was good for you?" So I pursued it one course at a time over the next years, and having had that goal gave the New Yorker a way to be paterfamilias, and they were very supportive, letting me extra people to go off to courses in at NYU, and also to teach a course in Vassar. It was nice.
Well, the book is fascinating, and it's just a beautifully written book. It's The Receptionist, an Education at the New Yorker. It's published by Algonquin. Janet Groth, thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck with the volume.
Thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, it's The Receptionist, an Education at the New Yorker, published by Algonquin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.